This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U-Mobile.
Today on the Breakfast Grill, we are talking to YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, as well as being the Member of Parliament for Bangi. Now, YB, welcome back to BFM. You've been here many times, but obviously today in your position as International Trade Deputy Minister. Now, in terms of where your remit sits and your portfolio, perhaps we can start the discussion with the key priorities for you within the first 6 to 12 months of your position.
When I was sworn in as Deputy Minister of MITI, the Minister, YB Datuk Daryl Lai King, and I, you know, we sat down and then we looked at a couple of areas, in terms of key priority areas in the first 100 days as a minister and deputy. And five areas of focus that we wanted to look at was firstly, letting the world know that Malaysia is still open for business and we are still accepting of FDIs coming in. So one of the things that we did was to restart the National Committee on Investments that approve investment, especially FDI approvals, into the country. Second area of our focus was our trade and economic relationship with China, which is our largest trading partner for the past 9 years and also for the past 2 years and likely for this year as well, the largest country of destination in terms of FDI. So we wanted to make sure that we let our Chinese friends know that Malaysia still welcomes Chinese investments, but with certain conditions. You know, we want the investments to be high tech. We want the business opportunities to be given to Malaysian companies as well as Malaysian workers. And then the third area would be in the area of relooking at our FTA agreements, which I think we'll talk about later as well. Fourth area is focusing on Industry 4.0, which was the policy was just launched last Wednesday by Yang Bang Bohmatun Dr. Mahathir. And then the fifth area would be in the area of looking at the various responsibilities of our agencies under MITI moving forward.
Okay, so let's start by examining and analyzing the whole issue with Chinese investment. They've been our biggest trading partner for at least the last nine years. Much has been telegraphed about Tun Mahathir's disdain for the investments that have been inked with Malaysia and China up until his tenure as the second tenure as Prime Minister. What kind of reactions within China and Beijing have been received since those messages of disdain have been put forth?
I think what the comments that Dr. Mahathir made needs to be put into context because they have not been targeted, for example, at all Chinese investments. I think he selected a few. One of them is a property development, project in Johor. And then the other one was in context of steel investment in Kuantan. And I think at that time, he perhaps was not aware of all the facts since he was not briefed previously when he was not Prime Minister. And when he visited China, that was his third international visit after he became Prime Minister. He was welcomed very warmly and he reiterated the need for us to have a very strong trade and economic relationship with China. So I think since that trip, would be able to see that our Prime Minister has been very careful in terms of his wording on how we treat Chinese investments. And I think, Minister Daryl is now in China. This is his second visit after taking office. And I myself, I've been to China already for two working trips. And the message that we wanted to send was what I said just now. We're open for business. We want Chinese investments to come in, but with certain conditions. And I think the Prime Minister has also indicated to us that is his direction.
What are the indications of interest? Because at the end of the day, Malaysia competes with other ASEAN neighbours of equivalent, if not better, infrastructure and tax regimes. Malaysia's budget 2019 did not offer much more beneficial situations where corporation tax was involved or individual tax. Malaysia loses out to Singapore in that regard. What have the early indications of interest been?
I think in terms of tax incentives, That's a topic for another discussion. But in terms of Chinese investments coming to Malaysia, although they welcome certain tax incentives, the main reason why they want to set up their operations here in Malaysia, the genuine and the legitimate good quality investments, is not because of the tax incentives. They like our location in terms of being a hub in Southeast Asia. They like the fact that they can have access to Chinese-speaking human resource that can help them with their initiatives and investments, not just in Malaysia, but also in ASEAN and other parts of the world as well. They like the fact that we are not as expensive as Singapore, and we also have good infrastructure. So the Chinese companies are actually very smart in terms of choosing certain locations in Malaysia to invest in for various sectors of the economy. So E&E will go up to Penang. Some of those are larger, heavy industries that require cheap energy. They go to Sarawak. Others which require a deep port and also ample land, they will go to Kuantan. So they've actually, diversified their investments in the manufacturing sector, across different regions in Malaysia.
To what extent does Chinese involvement, hinge on having additional infrastructure like the East Coast Rail Link or the High-Speed Rail in the equation and over the medium to long term?
I think the East Coast Rail Link would have had a little bit of a boost in terms of transporting some of the materials manufactured in Kuantan. But the good thing about this Malaysia-China Kuantan Industrial Park in Kuantan is that it has access to a very good port in the Kuantan port. And it has a harbour that has been deepened. It has a lot of excess capacity. And most of the manufacturing interest that's in that particular park is very export-intensive. So they intend to use the Kuantan port to import their raw materials, and then they also intend to use the Kuantan port to export their raw materials to ASEAN and other parts of the world.
Okay, well, things have changed by a great deal since the since the May elections. Yeah. But to what extent, if at all, under the new regime, is the involvement of Chinese infrastructure companies in Malaysia hinge upon? Or to what extent does investment in Malaysia hinge upon the involvement of Chinese large infrastructure companies?
Okay.
You know what I mean by that?
Yes,
right?
I do. I think in terms of the larger national picture, obviously many Chinese companies are looking at the lead of and the message that's being sent out by the Chinese government in terms of their relationship with the new government here in Malaysia. And that's why I say it's important that Dr. Mahathir went to China, and there would be follow-up visits by other ministers as well to show the commitment of this relationship. So once that signal is sent that it's okay to invest in Malaysia, I do believe that Chinese companies will be open to coming to Malaysia to invest. But
not on the condition that its big companies get to build out the East Coast Rail Link or build out the High-Speed Rail.
Exactly. So I think, once the signal is sent that it's okay to invest in Malaysia, I think what we need to do in Malaysia is to send the signal to say that these are the investments that we want. On the infrastructure investments, something that needs to be sustainable and make financial sense for Malaysia, those are the kind of infrastructure investments that we are interested in. But I think on my side, on the MITI side, what we are more interested in is actually on the manufacturing and manufacturing services side. So that would, I think, be able to give us much more long-term potential in terms of growth, economic growth and jobs.
Well, we find ourselves in a situation where the US and China are at loggerheads over their trade policies. For us, the larger picture is reducing the dependence of North America and that part of the world on the way we do business. So intra-ASEAN trade is more important, and obviously our links with China are also very important.
Yeah.
How are you building that out?
Yeah, I think we cannot ignore our trading relationship with both China and US, and they also remain a very important source of FDI. But moving forward, you're right. Many countries are looking to trade diversification. And in the Malaysian context, we are involved in a couple of free trade agreements. Now, the one that's being negotiated very, very seriously is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, comprising of the ASEAN countries, the plus three partners in China, Japan and Korea, and then also another three countries, Australia, New Zealand, as well as India. So you can see that is one parcel of trade diversification strategy. And then the other one is, of course, the CPTPP, the Comprehensive Partnership, that is the successor to the TPP. So this is 11 countries minus the US, and includes three countries that we don't have any FTAs with currently, which is Canada, Mexico, as well as Peru. And Canada and Mexico are among the top 15 GDP nations in the world.
We are talking today to the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, Dr. Ong Kian Ming, or YB, Dr. Ong Kian Ming, who also is the Member of Parliament for Bangi. We're going to be coming back and we're going to be discussing the CPTTPP as well as the RCEP with him in just a few minutes. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
YB, Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, as well as being the Member of Parliament for Bangi, with us on the grill this morning. Now, we are going to be talking about the trade agreements, as you mentioned earlier, but before we get into that, perhaps your point of view on the national car, or the third national car that's been postulated by the Prime Minister, that is also shaping up to be an ASEAN car. You've talked in the past of having 12 or 13 parties interested in taking part in this project. Who are they, and what is the larger picture here?
Start off with the larger picture first. I think we should not discuss the third national car project in isolation, because what is more important for us to consider is the whole automotive sector. My ministry is currently undergoing a review process of the national automotive policy. The last review was done in 2014. The next one is due early next year in 2019. And what this entails is to look at the entire automotive ecosystem, which includes, for example, the other CKD players, the other car players such as Perodua, the vendors that supply the CKD as well as Proton and Perodua, and then also the other infrastructure or ecosystem related issues such as, for example, if we want to introduce more hybrid as well as electric cars, you know, we're talking about batteries, we're talking about charging stations, we're talking about motorcycles and electric bicycles and motorcycles as well. So, the larger picture would be, you know, looking at things from a larger automotive sector. In terms of the, national car itself, we've received more than 20 proposals to date. These are from individuals, from private sector, some from GLC companies. So we have a matrix in which we analyze and evaluate each of these proposals. And this will be part and parcel of the consultative process by which we come up with a much more, comprehensive approach towards this question of this third national car and how it would look like.
Well, without naming names, because I know you can't at this point, but which proposal seems to be getting the most interest from you, and why?
I think what we're looking for are proposals which are financially sustainable on the part of the parties that are proposing.
As in the government doesn't need to put in money.
Exactly. And you've seen that in the 2019 budget already. There's been no commitment made by the government in terms of funding and a third national car project. So whatever proposals that comes in from the various companies will have to include a serious financial proposal to make this viable.
Okay, so you still haven't really put any meat to the bone. Which proposal has gotten your attention, and why?
I think it's too early for us to reveal details. But when the National Automotive Policy is announced early next year, I think we'll have more clarity on that. I think the Prime Minister also has very strong ideas on this, and he does communicate very regularly with my minister, Dato' Daryl Liking, on some of the key aspects of this policy.
Okay, well, the national auto policy has been postponed many times in the past. We have been looking to governments, both present and past, for some direction for an otherwise nascent industry. Of course, some of the chief issues include the whole issue of approved permits and local APs and foreign APs. It's one of the biggest impediments to the development of the local industry sector, as well as the fact that we've got two national cars and we're adding a third. So perhaps you can address those
issues.
Actually,
on the EP issue, I don't think the EP issue is a big impediment to the development of the automotive industry.
Well, it drives up prices.
No, actually, if you think about the AP numbers, the AP permits itself is somewhere between 20 to 40,000 APs a year, which is less than 10% of the total automotive market. I think what is important for us to note is also the fact that we actually have a relatively robust vendor supply chain in Malaysia, providing things like car components, seat belts, and whatnot. And in fact, this is has to do with the localization of many of the CKD cars in Malaysia. So, we supply maybe 70 to 80% of our car components here in Malaysia from a local perspective.
So I see why you're taking it from an industry and manufacturing perspective, but for the consumer perspective, which is where most of us are, The AP system has basically artificially distorted the market and driven up prices, and it's also reduced the number of choices available to local consumers because of the people that have been holding APs. It's also enabled corruption. So are you saying that you support the AP system and you want it to continue?
There are no plans right now to abolish the AP system. I think what we are trying to do is to review the system so that you don't have a situation of Alibaba's being used in the AP process, whereby people just apply for these APs and then they sit on it or they sell it to somebody else at an inflated price.
But how are you going to upset that apple cart if you don't remove it?
No, we're trying to review the process so that, you know, legit players are the ones that really contribute to the, you know, to the sort of like AP process of, you know, selling cars which cannot be assembled on a CKD basis. But like I said, what is important to the consumer is actually the CKD and as well as the local production market, because this is where I think you've seen over the years the prices of many of these CKD cars have come down. So much so that, you know, some the largest player after Perodua is now Honda. And most of their cars are actually produced locally. So I don't disagree with the contention that this may artificially restrict choice, because you know, some of these imported models that are not produced locally would be much more expensive. But in terms of you're talking about your CRVs, your HRVs, your other more basic Honda models, you know, Toyota models, they are already manufactured in Malaysia. So the pricing has actually gone down quite significantly.
On the grill this morning, YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, as well as the Member of Parliament for Bangi, with us on the grill this morning. Now, in the context of what we talked about with automotive manufacturing, your remits within the government is Industry 4.0, and Industry 4.0 entails a laundry list of items that Malaysia wants to move into, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's machine learning, whether it's big data, whether it's the Internet of Things, and all these things which are highfalutin and really sexy, but they're very expensive. It's crowded by big global players with lots of money. How does Malaysia tackle Industry 4.0?
Okay, so Industry 4.0 is not just about the automotive sector. It is about the manufacturing and manufacturing services sector. It is one component of the industrial revolution, for the fourth industrial revolution. The manufacturing sector is, of course, a very important component of the Malaysian economy, and MITI is the one coordinating efforts on Industry 4.0. You are absolutely right in saying that there are many high-floating ideas. I think even if you let you know, you ask relatively well-informed people what is Industry 4.0 to you, I think they would have trouble giving a very comprehensive picture. I would just explain it in this way. It is a manufacturing process whereby there are much more interconnected parts in which we have to use various new processes in order to improve productivity of the manufacturing sector. In terms of the Industry 4.0 policy that was launched last week, I would describe the 11 components in a way which I hope is easy for people to remember. I would say that there are 5 A's, 1 B, 2 C's, 1 I, and 2 S's, right? And I will sort of like quickly go through each one of them, just say what they are. So for under the 5 A's, it will be additive manufacturing, it will be advanced materials, it will be autonomous robots, it will be artificial intelligence, it will be augmented reality or virtual reality. Under the B, you mentioned already, big data. Under the C, there's 2 C's, cyber security, as well as cloud computing. Under I, Internet of Things, and under S, systems integration, and then also simulation. So, you know, these are 11 components of Industry 4.0. Of course, we don't expect all industries, all manufacturing sectors to embrace all 11 components. What we want to do in MITI is to be able to have a readiness assessment to understand where are the areas under Industry 4.0 that are the most relevant to particular sectors of the economy, and push SMEs, especially in those sectors, to go ahead and to try to upgrade themselves along those particular sectors, not all 11.
So the problem with the blueprints is that they tend to be very idealistic and quite formulaic in nature, but in terms of practical rollout, that's where the devil lies, right?
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And you've talked about the SME. I mean, under Budget 2019, there's been certain breaks given to SMEs with, you know, paid-up capital below 2.5 million ringgit, lower corporation taxes. You've also got a lot of TVET policies to train and upskill people within the skills area. So there's a lot of initiatives on that front, but what is the priority, maybe in ranking 1, 2 and 3, for Malaysia?
No, I think in terms of Industry 4.0, the priority will be in the implementation. And you are absolutely right to say that, you know, SMEs may not know the direction you know, that they need to go moving forward. What my ministry would need to do is to be able to show champions in various sectors that SMEs can emulate and learn from in terms of Industry 4.0, and then you know, be able to take the necessary steps to get there. So, for example, in the 11 areas that I talked about just now, under the readiness assessment framework, we are able to evaluate how each company fares on each of these 11 components and, you know, be able to say, look, for this particular sector, for this particular company, you are ranked, you know, you have a rating of 2.2 out of 5 in terms of big data. And big data is one sector that you're, one area in which your sector really needs to focus on. So we need to show this particular SME or this the SMEs in this sector, 1, 2, 3, good champions that have used big data in a way to improve their manufacturing processes, and then use whatever funding that we have from the various government policies that are already in place or announced recently in Budget 2019, and then we'll be able to deliver these, move them on the ground, and hopefully after 1, 2, 3 years, we'll be able to see the results and showcase these companies that have learned from these champions.
So it's more like a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach.
Oh, yes, very much so.
So there is no real finite numbers in terms of let's push this sector before this sector and this sector. It's really where our existing industries are and where they're probably most quick to move on.
Yeah, we have some high-level objectives in terms of increasing the per capita productivity of our workers in the manufacturing sector, but this has to be fulfilled through implementation from a bottom-up approach.
So why does the poverty line matter to someone like you? Is it because it's basically getting everybody in on the productive workforce and to contribute on a on a national productivity level?
So it's quite simple. If, let's say, our workers move, our companies move towards Industry 4.0, we'll have more automation, we'll have more value-added kind of manufacturing processes. You'll be dealing more, each worker will be using and dealing more with a greater level of our capital investment and machines. And because of that, they will have more responsibilities, companies will be earning more money, and they would also be earning higher wages at the same time.
So the national minimum wage has been upped to 1,100 ringgit,
yes.
Not as high as 1,500 as earlier wanted, but 1,100. You've also said that the poverty line is too low. So, I mean, they seem to be diametrically opposing concepts, what we talked about with Industry 4.0 and these basic economic terms, but they all come together and coalesce to make sense, right? Can you make sense of that?
Yeah, of course. If let's say, you know, I've said that the poverty line index is too low, you know, in KL, if let's say you're making 1,100, under current PLI indexes, you won't be classified as poor. But, you know, if let's say you raise it to, let's say, 1,002 or 1,003 in KL, you'll find that actually the minimum wage may not be sufficient for a family of four to survive on. Of course, you know, household, there are more people, more than just one person works. That's why the household income is actually higher than 1,001 or 1,002 or 1,003 or 1,004. But if, let's say, we are able to move the manufacturing sector ahead, increase the productivity, then the minimum wage of 1,100 actually doesn't really apply, because you'll be able to pay far higher wages even at the entry level. You know, we're looking at people in the manufacturing sector even now paying up to 1,800 ringgit for a fresh diploma graduate coming out to work. And if, let's say, they are able to skill and upskill themselves, they'll be earning 2,000-4,000 in a very, very short period of time.
We have with us on the grill this morning YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, as well as being the Member of Parliament for Bangi. We're going to be coming back after the news, and we're going to be talking to you about the free trade agreements like the RCEP and the CPTPP, which some naysayers say are no good for Malaysia and should be not be ratified, but you seem to disagree. We'll come back with that. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
We have on the grill with us this morning YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy International Trade Minister, as well as being the MP for Bangi. Now, the CPTPP and more immediately the RCEP. Now, these are framed free trade agreements that you're discussing yourself. But what do you say to critics who say that these trade agreements are not only injurious to small jurisdiction exporters like ourselves, but they also drive up costs and will marginalise us over the long term?
I would say in general, from a macro perspective, Malaysia has benefited from free trade as well as free trade agreements in a sense that Malaysia is an open and trading nation. We are one of four countries in Southeast Asia where trade as a percentage of GDP is more than 100%. Singapore is ahead, followed by Vietnam, followed by us, and followed by Thailand. So we do want to be able to continue to operate in a context, a global context, where free trade is something that is the norm. But at the same time, under the new government, we also want to emphasize the need for fair trade as well, in the sense that we do not want any free trade agreements whereby the little guy like us are caught between giants, and then we don't we are bullied into accepting less than optimal outcomes for our country. So, you know, that's where I think the discussion on RCEP as well as CPTPP and also future free trade agreements that we may be negotiating comes in.
Well, that's the problem, because they are putting the smaller countries. We have signed on, but we haven't ratified the CPTPP. And if we haven't done so by December 2018.
Yes. Yeah.
We're told we're going to be playing catch up. And catch up means we're going to be losing the first year of benefits.
So the CPTPP has already been ratified by six countries, Singapore, Japan, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So once six out of the 11 countries ratify the CPTPP, something called entry into force will take place 60 days later.
And they get to play with each other.
Basically it means that the first round of tariff reductions as agreed upon in the CPTPP will take effect for those six countries, but not for Malaysia, because we have not ratified it. Some people have said that, yes, we can take our time to ratify it. I would say that there are pros and cons. The pros would be we can see what other countries that have not ratified it, are doing. For example, Vietnam and Brunei and a few others. But at the same time, there are cons as well, because we won't have access to some of the tariff reductions in these countries. So, for example, palm oil access to Mexico and Canada. Currently, the tariff rates are 10 to 15%. We don't ratify it by the end of the year, then we'll not be able to benefit from that. Same thing with government procurement, access to government procurement in the six countries that have already ratified it. So there are some pros, but there are also some cons that we need to be aware of.
Well, some people also say that it's going to drive up costs. For example, for medicines, and a lot of the punitive measures under the TPP, which is the original forebear of the CPTPP, continue to exist. And I think more importantly, it's really the investor-state dispute settlement system, which allows governments to sue us outside of the normal legal system if they feel that the intellectual property rights have been infringed.
Let me deal with those two issues separately. Firstly, on the intellectual property rights area first. This was an issue that myself and many other MPs, including those from the opposition, expressed concern about. But with the pullout of the US from the TPP, many of the articles relating to intellectual property rights, especially to do with the protection of the pharmaceutical industry, has been suspended already. This was an area where other countries in the TPP then also had some concerns about, including Canada as well as New Zealand. And incidentally, both Canada and New Zealand had change of governments after the TPP was signed. Like I said just now, both new governments in Canada and New Zealand, with the suspension of some of the more problematic articles to do with intellectual property, as well as with ISDS, also decided to ratify the CPTPP. So I think some of those concerns have been assuaged. Okay, on the ISDS, I think this is probably the thorniest issue which has been raised by various people, including some of my colleagues in Parliament from Pakatan Harapan. I do take note of their concerns, and I think some of these concerns need to be addressed, in the sense that we do not want a situation whereby Malaysia can be unfairly treated within the context of an international tribunal. People have said, look, you know, these international tribunals are unfair to Malaysia because countries outside Malaysia can sue the Malaysian government. But at the same time, I think we also need to acknowledge that Malaysian investors in other countries also can benefit from some of these protections. Because I'm not sure how many people are aware, but more and more Malaysian companies are actually investing abroad now. And they would benefit from some of these investment guarantee agreements. So for the benefit of your listeners, ISDS is not something that's new within the context of the CPTPP. We have over 70 investment guarantee agreements that are similar to the ISDS, which currently do allow foreign governments to sue Malaysia. And in fact, foreign companies to sue the Malaysian government. In the last 40 years where we've had these IGAs, only two cases involving these ISDS-like cases have been brought up against the Malaysian government. And in both cases, the parties that brought up these cases lost those cases against the Malaysian government.
So between now and December, which is not a lot of time, it's about a month and a half, what are the indications that Malaysia will ratify the CPTPP?
Our government has not made a decision on whether we want to ratify it or not. I think we are still evaluating all the pros and cons. And like I said just now, I've outlined some of the pros and cons already. We won't be able to ratify it, in the next 2 months, in the sense that ratification involves amending about 17 laws in the Malaysian Parliament. So we won't be able to finish that process, even if, let's say, the cabinet decides tomorrow, for example, to start the ratification process. I think that the cabinet would have to make a decision, and within the following year, in 2019, we should be in a better position to be able to evaluate all the pros and cons and see the larger global trading picture, and then to decide whether or not we want to go on to ratify it. I just want to say one thing about the ISDS and the CPTPP, in the sense that, yes, we are concerned about some of the provisions in the ISDS, but we should also be aware that the ISDS issue is not the only thing that is important within the CPTPP. In fact, there are 20 chapters in the CPTPP. Many of them would be able to provide a greater market access for Malaysian companies, and also at the same time increase transparency on the domestic front on issues such as government procurement, and improve areas such as labour rights in Malaysia. So I think it's not accurate to sort of like say that the ISDS is the be-all and end-all of the CPTPP, and we should not throw out the baby with the bathwater just because we have some concerns about the ISDS provisions.
So, Kian Ming, you look swamped. You sound swamped. You got a lot of things on your plate, but you're also the Member of Parliament for Bangi. It's the biggest constituency in the country. 140,000 people in that.
180,000.
180,000, yes. I stand corrected, after the delineation,
yes, after the delineation.
You won that by a landslide. Over 100,000 people voted for you.
Yes, my majority was about 68,000.
That's right. So you've promised a lot of things. You promised to abolish toll roads. You promised to upgrade water tanks, road infrastructure, bus connectivity, to clean up the river. How are you going on that front?
Well, we just had an event on the World Rivers Day on the 30th of September, and I'll be having another event in a couple of weeks' time to not just clean up a river, but also to create a sort of like a walking and a cycling trail next to the Langat River. This is done in conjunction with the Friends of the Langat River. And there are a lot more other constituency issues which my team and I and also the councillors are focusing on.
How well supported are you there? Because obviously a lot of the time seems to be in the trade ministry.
Yes, I think initially, because it's a new portfolio in the federal government, I need to focus much more of my time on the federal responsibilities first. But I think as I am more familiar with my federal responsibilities, many of the plans that I want to do in the constituency level would also be able to get implemented now, especially because we have access to federal resources, including funding as well as the various ministries. So with the strong support of my team, I'm quite confident that we'll be able to do many of these programs in the Bangi area.
Well, YB, we wish you the best of luck and good luck.
Thank you very much for speaking about a year's time
with some measurable progress being made. There's YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry, as well as the Member of Parliament for Bangi, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.